You know, you're doing a scene call, clearly a big injury. You're pulling back the blankets and you're seeing this. Like, you don't have time for complex math. You don't have time for super sophisticated diagrams. Not then. We'll have that luxury 48 hours later after we've debrided and all this stuff under better circumstances in a burn center. But in the heat of the moment, you need something that's easy to use, reasonably accurate, and just, you know, fast, easy to remember.
Here you on 8. Here you on 8. Okay, you're clear. Stand by for your base.
Welcome to EMS Cast. Before we jump into this episode, I just wanted to set you up. We had such a good time talking with our guest, Derek Miller, and he had so much good stuff to teach us on burns that this episode went a little longer than our usual. So in order to continue to keep this bite-sized and digestible for you guys, we decided to split this talk into two parts. This is part one, where we get into the immediate life threats about burns, calculating surface area, and initial thoughts about fluid resuscitation. We'll release part two on May 1st, where we'll simplify our thoughts on fluid resuscitation and cover some more nuanced topics such as IV access, burn center destination criteria, and electrocution injuries. Hold on tight, Derek does a phenomenal job talking us through burn pathophysiology and considerations of treatment.
Welcome to EMS Cast, where we provide high-level education to you, the providers on the streets. I'm your host, Will Berry, and I'm a critical care paramedic in North Carolina, and I'm joined once again by my co-host, Ross Orprit. Hey, Ross.
Hey, Will. How's it going?
It's going really well, man. I'm excited for tonight's episode. Tonight, we're going to be talking about burns, and we have with us Derek Miller. Derek Miller is in charge of outreach for the UNC North Carolina JC Burn Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He has a master's of science in nursing, 17 years of nursing experience, 11 of which was in the burn unit. I mean, he's been in this current role for 3 years. Before we dive in, Derek, I just wanted to say when I started as a paramedic, burn patients were kind of my biggest fear. They just seemed horrific. I think I was honestly afraid of how disfiguring they can be, how life-altering it is for people, and I just know they're incredibly painful. While working 911, I ran a couple of really sick burn patients, and it kind of demystified it a bit for me. I feel like I learned a lot of the true burn care happens long-term after the fact. It's a really long journey for these folks. And so first off, I just want to say you guys that work in the burn center are like second to saints in my book. It is very intimate care. It is very hands-on with very sick patients. So first off, thank you. But also, jumping back to my experience as a paramedic, when I realized that the real meat and potatoes of the burn care happens at kind of the ICU level, it made the pre-hospital care a little less intimidating, with the exception of the math surrounding fluid resuscitation. There's always a question on every paramedic exam, flight paramedic exam, about fluid resuscitation and burns. You know, the only other time-sensitive stuff, you may manage their airway. You also need to get their pain under control, but the fluid math is very difficult. So that's what I want to talk to you about tonight. So first off, thank you for being here, and thank you for everything you do at the Burn Center.
It's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for the kind introduction.
Yeah, Derek, I'm going to second everything that Will said. I mean, you guys do amazing work in the burn ICU. I spent a month there during residency, and I can't say how much the nurses did and cared in that unit. And equally, I'm going to echo what Will said in the fact that these tend to be very intimidating patients in the emergency setting. But I think as you're going to see as we get down into it, it's actually a somewhat simple process with a few unique pathophysiologic components that we're going to address during our care.
Yeah, so to tee all this up, I wanted to present a case.
Sure.
So this happened to me just this last week. I flew to a rural community for a burn patient. They had a flammable liquid on them from roughly about their knees up to their chest level. And that flammable liquid had caught on fire. Don't really know why, but they were able to put themselves out. Local EMS and fire found the patient. They called for helicopter transport. They teed us up great, started two large bore IVs, had lactated ringers hanging, had given fentanyl, and drove the patient to a field where we met them. When I entered the back of their ambulance, it was a 40s-ish female, lots of pain. No other real signs of trauma. It was sounds like an isolated burn injury. No airway involvement, thankfully. It was isolated from kind of chest down. She had skin sloughing, blistering, and she admitted to some cocaine use and some marijuana use as well. So I'm going to refer back to that case in a minute, but that's what I was met. And I had like 16 burn things going through my head right off the bat. But before we get into that case too much, let's talk broadly about burn patients.
Sure.
So what makes a burn patient so unique and so different from another trauma patient?
Yeah, so I'd like to answer that part, but I'd also like to loop back to your tee up of that particular patient. And I love how you languaged your approach or your 16 burn things that are running through your head. So as we kind of dive into the meat of today's topic, fluid resuscitation, I think it's important to realize that, or to note that you said you didn't see any other signs of obvious trauma. So number one, burn patients can have more than one problem, and burns can be a distracting injury. So for anybody responding initially to a burn patient's injuries, let's be clear that we're doing a thorough trauma workup so we don't miss some type of injury that may kill the patient prior to burn shock coming into play. And we'll talk more about what burn shock is and is not, but I love that you put that wording in there. So a trauma-centric approach to burn assessment is key. Another thing that you mentioned, well, she had no obvious airway involvement. So that's also as key, because what we know is burn patients who die quickly or initially, airway loss is what I call one of the big three. Well, the two other big three being polytrauma or some other flavor of shock that we miss that kind of trumps the time priority of the burn. And the third of the big three is inhalation injury. So we tend to think of that as smoke, products of combustion, or as my friend Chris Craig says, it could be polyethyl methyl ethyl badness, right? So some kind of chemical pneumonitis of whatever it may be. But if we've looked at those three things, those actually can trump the thing which we tend to think of most, which is the fluid resuscitation. And then we get into maths.
Yeah. Yeah,
that tricky part.
So you're saying those three things are polytrauma.
Yeah, and I say polytrauma, although it could be other flavors of shock, i.e. I'll give you a random example. Let's say that this is an electrical line worker in his bucket truck. You know, he comes into contact with 7,000 volts. It could be that he falls from the aerial device and has, you know, broken ribs causing a liver lack, tension pneumo, or C5 fracture, now we have neurogenic shock. Or it could be, you know, the voltage is causing an alteration to his conduction system. So cardiogenic shock, which isn't necessarily classic trauma, if that makes sense. So some other flavor of shock, we tend to think trauma-centric, but any flavor of shock that's faster acting. Yes, sir.
Gotcha. So the three big things you're thinking of are shock, essentially, from
yes,
another
sir.
Cause,
mm-hmm.
Airway involvement,
mm-hmm.
and what was the third one that you think?
Yeah, breathing and badness, or
okay.
inhalation injury, where the airway itself is patent, but the gas exchange at the alveolar level is compromised because of, again, breathing in, it could be smoke, so the impairment of diffusion at the alveolar level, or it could be I have breathed in all this carbon monoxide as an example. And so this turns into a systemic toxicity problem of carbon monoxide poisoning or hydrogen cyanide, you know, et cetera. So there could be things in the smoke. Airway's fine. I'm ventilating. I see chest rise, but my blood gas is craptastic because, you know, things have gotten in my bloodstream that are hurting me.
Gotcha. So, you know, my case, we're looking at these three things basically before we're into the meat and potatoes of burn care. So with our case, she didn't have polytrauma or shock of another etiology. She didn't have airway involvement, and she didn't seem to have inhalation injury, but she inhaled some marijuana, so we'll say she had some inhalation. We'll just say she was happy on the inhalation front, perhaps.
Fair enough. Happy may be the right word, I guess. Yes.
So we've thought about those three things, and we're not seeing any red flags there. So what next?
So classically, and again, this leans into this trauma-centric approach, and it depends on how you're taught, which algorithms or alphabet soup speaks to you. I know in some military or pre-hospital circles, there's this concept of MARCH. So you're looking at massive hemorrhage, airway, respirations, etc. Or my background in nursing will kind of shoplift the TNCC approach, that ABCDE idea. So essentially, you're looking for those immediate threats to life. And I say immediate because burns can kill people, but the immediacy is really what we're looking at. Another way that I frame the priorities is thinking about the organs that matter most. And I jokingly say this reminds me of George Orwell's Animal Farm, you know, where all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others. And we love all organs, but some we love more.
Yeah.
So heart, brain, and lungs, which is a perspective, the spirit of your primary survey. So heart, brain, and lungs. So ABCs, we've got heart and lungs in there. So we'll look at anything obscuring neural status that's not explained by, again, polytrauma. Was there a fall, a TBI, something? Is this hypoxia, hypovolemia, etc.? So the idea is I'm looking for those immediate threats to life, and then I can, assuming there's nothing there that's going to trump time immediacy, then I can really wade into, well, how bad is the burn now? So spirit of the exercise is I'll get to the burn, but let's address those immediate, or I should say more immediate threats to life first.
Gotcha. You know, for me, faced with these patients outside the hospital when it's so close to the time of their injury, getting their pain under control quickly just feels important. I mean, they're in tons and tons of pain, and, you know, it's horrific just to sit. It just feels like the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it? Is there any science behind that?
Sure. Well, there is. And I would say there's two prongs to this. One piece is, if you will, the ethical piece of if there's something not more pressing, i.e. if they have imminent airway loss, then sure, let's address that. But it's an issue of time scale. Burn shock, which again I'd like to wade into, it is this progressive loss of plasma into the interstitial space progressively over hours. So we're talking a time scale of hours, and that's different than bleeding out over a course of minutes from, you know, again, I've severed my femoral artery from whatever it is. So if I have time, then let's go ahead and ethically address pain. There's other side of this. I know from experience, and I can only imagine on the pre-hospital side, without all the resources that I have in the BICU, when the patient literally is, you're having to scrape them off the ceiling because they're in that much pain, your limbic system is probably being activated too as the care provider, and it's making it harder to focus and be methodical. I make that up not having flown, not having done pre-hospital, but I know when we're dealing with patients, sometimes treating pain adequately is for the patient, but it also helps me so that I have a calmer, more lucid patient that I can then move on and get, you know, more information from.
100%. So let's say, you know, for the sake of our case, we have addressed pain. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting into what? Are we just going to start fluids, or are we getting into our estimation of total body surface area, or, you know, what should be next?
Sure. So I'll give you two answers to that. And you mentioned a common refrain that I hear when teaching pre-hospital folks, or this comes up when I'm doing outreach to nursing school students or to residents doing their training and trauma, whatever it is. People know fluid resuscitation. So we tend to think in those terms. And just please know that there's more than one formula out there. There's more than one approach to fluid resuscitation. But by far, people have heard of Parkland, which is arguably the gold standard, or at least the most well-known, at least in the U.S. So people tend to think in those terms. The reality is there's multiple steps of math to get right. There's multiple places where my estimations on the fly in the field, as I'm still sussing out, are there threats to life that I've missed? This patient, have I managed their pain well? They're still not quote-unquote trauma naked. And that's, for your listeners, that's N-E-K-K-E-D. We all know that, right?
That's a North Carolina, yes, that's a North Carolina term.
So sorry. Okay. It's going to be hard to get an accurate TBSA, a total body surface area. And I may be guesstimating their weight. And, you know, we don't work at the fair as the, you know, the person guessing people's weight, etc. So empirical eyeballing often can be substantially off. If my TBSA is off, well, that's two out of my three parameters that I would use for Parkland. So we could have a problem right away. And so for some years now, the ABA, the American Burn Association, has actually advocated, when I'm still in those initial moments during my primary, if I've addressed more immediate threats to life, again, the big three, that's my language that appears nowhere in ABAville, but the big three, again, some other form of shock that might trump airway loss or inhalation injury, but I have identified they have a clinically significant burn, then I just say, okay, they are burned. I know they will need fluid. I'll get access, and then I'll start something now, trusting that we can tweak that or adjust that as more information comes to light.
Derek, is there a level as we start to figure out, and we'll talk about how to kind of estimate or calculate total body surface area burned, but like, what's our threshold for, okay, this is a serious burn that needs fluids, that needs a burn center?
Great question. So nominally, it would be a 20% TBSA, or total body surface area, with the caveat, which we'll talk about, only second and third degree burns should be included in that TBSA. So nominally 20%, knowing that in the first few minutes of seeing a patient, I can estimate, but my estimate may be off in either direction. So we say, look, if it looks around 20% or more, based on your gestalt sense of what's happening, we're going to call that significant.
I'd like to pause for 1 second. So before we get into fluid calculation and the importance thereof and maybe some misconceptions, what's happening? Why are we so worried about fluid resuscitation in burn patients?
Great question. So it is critical that we keep coming back to why we want to give fluids, because I like to draw distinctions, this compare and contrast with what we're probably all more familiar with, which is trauma resuscitation broadly. So trauma resuscitation, we all know Stop the Bleed campaigns have impressed upon us that the number one most preventable cause of death in trauma is bleeding out or bleeding in. So massive hemorrhage as a preventable cause of death. And how I approach that is balanced resuscitation, etc. Now, not my place to give folks a thorough grounding in trauma resuscitation. We have other guests who can do that far better than me. But we know we're getting that in quickly, and blood products need to be a part of that equation sooner rather than later for good outcomes. Well, in burns, we know the hallmark of burns is that after a certain point of size, that local inflammation response transitions to a systemic inflammation response. And we see SIRS, or you'll hear it called systemic inflammatory response syndrome, the SIRS response that shows up in a variety of other diagnoses or injuries, but a root pathophys commonality is increased capillary permeability or cap leak, fluid loss from the intravascular space into the interstitium. So that's a key key piece to keep in mind.
And so I think what I'm hearing you say is that's happening locally in the burned tissue. But when you reach a threshold, and it's probably patient dependent, but maybe there is a guidepost there, it's going to happen systemically.
That is precisely correct. We know that there'll be local inflammation, but for larger burns, which again, our rule of thumb is by the time you're north of 20 to 30% TBSA, we know we're going to transition to a systemic response. Although you make a good point, it is somewhat patient specific. Not all 20% burns are the same. If I have lots of premorbidities, or if it's 20% third degree versus 20% second degree, or if I have an inhalation. So there's all these muddy water confounding factors. But beyond 20 to 30, I start seeing more of a systemic response.
Gotcha. And so with capillary permeability, mm-hmm. we're going to get fluid going from our intravascular space into the other places, right?
Sure.
Interstitial, and find its way into all kinds of spots.
Yes.
How long does this take?
Well, the answer depends. We know what's going to be ongoing. It's going to be ongoing. And classically, again, if we go back to what people are used to talking about, and that's Parkland, the moniker is that this estimates our resuscitation needs. It estimates what would be lost volume-wise in 24 hours. The reality is there's lots of data out there to suggest not every patient magically closes their capillary leak at 23 hours and 59 minutes. Many resuscitations can go beyond that, 36 hours, 48 hours. It tends to taper. So we know that capillary leak will gradually resolve, and the rate of fluid leak will gradually resolve, but there's no finite, discrete ending to that.
And can some fluid be lost externally? I would imagine the answer is yes, but is that a significant amount?
It can be, although for most burn patients, the fluid shifting, again, as you described, the intravascular leak into the interstitium, or I love also how you phrase that, other inappropriate places, because there's, you know, we know it's dynamic, and we're always equilibrating between interstitium, intracellular, extracellular, into cavities, so to speak.
Because, I mean, these patients in the ICU end up with swelling and all kinds of dependent spots.
Absolutely. It tends to be exacerbated in dependent spots. And as my predecessor, the illustrious Dr. Ernie Grant, would sum this up very technically as, they're all swole.
Yeah, some of these patients can end up with what's called like an abdominal compartment syndrome, right?
And I love that you went there. That's kind of one of my pet interests, because people tend to think of compartment syndrome in terms of limbs, right? Arms, legs, and it's not just burns, right? We know most often people encounter compartment syndrome in the context of, you know, crush injury, for example, or, you know, a tib-fib fracture that turns into that anterior tibial compartment, its most common area. So we tend to think of that, but compartment syndrome could be really in any compartment. And what we have known for a long time, abdominal compartment syndrome tends to get missed, number one, until it has very far progressed. And you can't play the five P's game, you know, the pain, pallor, paresthesia, poikilothermia, pulselessness. I always come up with like eight or nine P's, beyond five. You can't play that game when we're talking about the abdominal compartment. So it behaves differently. People aren't used to thinking of it, but it can induce oliguria.
Pooplessness, would that be a P?
Yes, pooplessness, which that's a moral hazard, right? The patient's not pooping. I'm a happy man, right? So I'm not treating that. I'm going to let that one ride, right? So I'll do a therapeutic finger pull on the patient to see if that kind of primes the pump. But the abdominal compartment syndrome is insidious in burns because it does not manifest how people are used to thinking about it. And then if you imagine if their urine begins to diminish reflexively, I know in burns, burn patients need fluid. Unless I'm very careful, the gravitational pull will be for me to increase my fluids because of the oliguria. And this creates a vicious cycle. And there's great data out there. I'll reference some articles that you gentlemen can post the links to those articles on the podcast website. But there's great data to suggest that for, let's say, burns greater than 60%, which that's a life-threatening injury, in the presence of abdominal compartment syndrome, once you approach 60%, as an example, mortality exceeds 90%. Hmm. So this is an ominous finding at that point in time.
Wow. So back to our case. So we've established that once the burn injury takes place, there is fluid shifting that has been initiated. Mm-hmm. And sounds like the first 24 hours are probably the most critical of that, but we have the opportunity, and probably it's important that we intervene early in this in the pre-hospital context, or else I would assume these formulas wouldn't even exist. So mm-hmm. why is it important for care providers that are with these patients so early in this process to begin replenishing some of these fluids?
Sure. So if we know the fluid is leaking progressively, I would rather stay well perfused than suffer hypoperfusion, because then we get into that ugly cycle of hypoperfusion, reperfusion injury. But we know, number one, we don't want to get into hypovolemia to begin with. And number two, if I am in that scenario, it's exceedingly difficult to play catch up, so to speak. If I'm quote unquote behind on my fluids, which I'd like to pick that apart a bit. That's a concept worth exploring, because people can have misapprehensions. But if I am behind, it's very difficult to make that fluid up.
Well, pick that apart a bit. What do you mean by getting behind in your fluids? And what do you mean by the nuances of that?
Sure. So I'm going to steal some language from one of your prior podcasts. When we're talking about visual constructs, let's say diagrams and whatnot, it's a little bit difficult in a, you know, an auditory medium, right? But if you imagine kind of a right-tailed distribution where the x-axis will be our time, and the vertical scale, or the y-axis, if you like, will be the rate of fluid administration. Okay, so vertical scale, rate of fluid administration, x-axis is the time scale. So one article that's just fantastic in shining a light on this complex topic, it's called, or one of their titles is, Fluid Begets More Fluid. So what they looked at is they compared the modified Brooks formula with the Parkland formula. So the modified Brooks formula uses 2 cc's per percent TBSA per kilogram of body weight. And that sounds familiar. The Parkland uses 4. So on paper, twice as much. And you multiply those out, and that gives you the 24-hour total. The other thing that's true to both formulas is that we're going to divide or aim for the first half of that fluid in the first 8 hours post-injury. So if you'll recall, I mentioned that the diagram is right-tailed, meaning it peaks early and then kind of tapers off to the right, if you can imagine that in your mind's eye. So the reason for that is, again, every patient's different. There's lots of caveats and asterisks to put in there. Every patient's different, but we think that the fluid leak, the rate of leaking through the impaired, I'm going to get nerdy here, the impaired glycocalyx, which is the important structure of the endothelial wall, of the endovascular structure, basically the lining of the blood vessels. So we think that the leak is at its peak around the 8 to 12 hours mark. Doesn't mean that it can't last significantly beyond, but we think it's its worst then. So we're going to try to stay ahead of things by giving most of the fluid they need when the leak is at its most. So this study that I mentioned, Fluid Begets More Fluid, it was done by the Institute of Surgical Research out of Brooke Army Medical Center, or BAMC, you may hear it called. So they were looking at deployed soldiers, and they really wanted to know to dial in for real which formula should we be using to optimize outcomes. Should we be using door number one, the Parkland, 4 milliliters as my coefficient, my multiplier, or modified Brooks, the 2cc multiplier? So they found some really fascinating things when they actually looked at the data by tracking patient response. So number one, they found it didn't really matter what people started at. Everybody got more than what was predicted. Okay, so everybody was actually given more than what the formulas suggested. Okay, so there's an inertia to, again, this human nature piece. So how to explain that? Well, I can say anecdotally, resuscitating many patients and participating in that inside a burn center, during the early phases, it is far easier for a practitioner to go up on fluids. Because in our mind, we know patients who are burned need fluids. They probably need more. Fast to go up, easy to go up, slower to come down. And so, as an example, and again, I'll refer folks to these articles for the nuance here. This is an approximation. But let's say Parkland. Now, the estimates suggest that over a 24-hour period, they should get 4 mils per kg of body weight per percent TBSA. They found that, on average, folks were getting closer to 6 milliliters, so almost 50% more than the fluid formula suggested, predicted, or advised. The second thing, besides that people tended to get more than what the formula would predict, was that, and this will hopefully make sense, if folks started higher, they tended to get more over the 24-hour period, which kind of makes sense. You start higher, you get more overall. If you can imagine my diagram before the right-tailed tapered curve, the total amount of fluid you can think of as area under the curve, if you will. So vertical scale being the rate, horizontal scale being the time, total area under the curve would be total fluids administered. So starting higher means you're probably going to give more over that time period. And people tend to be, or I should say practitioners, tend to be very reluctant to come down on fluids, even if physiologic endpoints, if markers of adequate resuscitation are being met, i.e. making good urine output, blood pressure and heart rate behaving appropriately, etc. People tend to still be slow to come down on fluids, which raises the specter of over-resuscitation.
So speaking broadly, there is a sweet spot in the middle. We can under-resuscitate and we can over-resuscitate. Let's get into, in the field, these initial moments. We need to estimate total body surface area. I'll be honest, in the case that I just mentioned, what I did, I pulled the blanket off the patient and I wanted to look. Then what I do is I usually short circuit on rule of nines, trying to remember what's what. And so I personally, to get it down and dirty, fall back to palmar surface. Because for me, it's just, at that point, it's just counting. It's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But in that, so I'm getting a rough TBSA, but I'm also getting to look at what is burned. So then when I actually get to look at a chart later, I can really hone in on it.
Mm-hmm. Will or Derek, explain that to us more. What are the rule of nines and what's the palmar surface rule?
Well, I'll explain palmar surface because it's the easiest and I'll leave the hard stuff up to Derek. So in essence, your palm, if you close all your fingers and bring your thumb in next to your hand, your palm should be 1% of your total body surface area. Obviously, if I held my hand up to my two-year-old, that's not going to be 1% of her total body surface area. It's only for me. So if I'm looking at a burn and, you know, Derek is burned and I'm looking at him, he's sitting across from me and we have the same size hand roughly, I can kind of go down his body and sort of measure it with my palmar surface just to get a rough estimate. Personally, I like that because you're kind of getting in there and saying like, well, this one, it kind of starts here, stops there, the margins here, margins there, especially this patient I described in the case, because of having a burning liquid on her, It was very splotchy. It would kind of start and stop, and maybe there was thick clothing here that prevented it from burning and not so much on this other part of her body. So that's, for me, to get my very first down and dirty initial estimation, that works for me. But Derek, will you get us into rule of nines and what other tools that exist?
Yeah, no, this is great because, you know, we talked about Parkland and modified Brooks, and that assumes we know what TBSA is. So how do we get there? So it's a non-trivial question. It's fantastic.
But the two things are intertwined.
They
you
are.
Can't pull them apart.
Yeah, you know? No. Very interconnected. So I will say you did a fantastic job describing Palmer's surface method, and I believe you called it the Palmer method, and I call it the Palmer surface method, and here's why. Here's why. I love that you delineated between your palm and your two-year-old's palm, because it really we're talking about the patient's palm as 1% of their body. So you make a fantastic teaching point there. If I put my hands on an infant, I'm radically going to underestimate the size of the burn. But we call it palmar surface because it's not just the palm itself, but it is the palmar surface of the fingers. And again, this is where visually I like to hold my hand up, but it's the entire palm and fingers together, not apart. Because if I spread my hand out, it's going to cover a kind of a wider area, changes what I'm talking about. So I like to delineate its palm plus fingers with the fingers together versus apart, so to speak. And that entire palmar surface is approximately 1% of the patient's surface area. Then it's a fantastically useful tool for scattered or irregular burns, much like a scald or much like this flammable liquid case that you're speaking of. So the power of palmar surface method is really in the fine tuning or when it's scattered and irregular. Well, why is that? Well, we'll hearken back or loop back to our other rule that most people have heard of, typically in the same breath as Parkland, because they tend to go together. And that's the rule of nines, or the Wallace rule of nines, if you prefer. So number one, it's adult-centric, which we'll come to. But it says, look, let's make this easy. So it's the KISS principle.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted, right? So make it as easy as we can, because in the heat of the moment, as you described, as you're doing a scene call, she's in a lot of pain, clearly a big injury. You're pulling back the blankets and you're seeing this. Like, you don't have time for complex math. You don't have time for super sophisticated diagrams. Not then. We'll have that luxury 48 hours later after we've debrided and all this stuff under better circumstances in a burn center. But in the heat of the moment, you need something that's easy to use, reasonably accurate, and just, you know, fast, easy to remember. So the Wallace Rule of Nine says, all right, take the adult human body and divide it into multiples of nine. So we're going to start with the easy part. So we'll take an arm, the whole arm and nothing but the arm. We'll say from axle all the way down to fingertips, front and back, the entirety of the arm. That would be the first multiple of nine, just flat out nine. Okay, so an arm, a whole arm is worth nine. The other arm, of course, is worth nine. We're going to say the head and neck, all of it, front and back, the entirety is nine. Well, we know legs are bigger than arms. A leg is twice an arm. So we're going to say 18. Again, that's why I say multiples of nine. So a leg is worth 18. And the anterior torso from neck down to the inguinal folds, that'll be 18. And the entire posterior trunk would be 18, again, from nape at the neck all the way down to the gluteal folds. And for my male listeners out there, I apologize. That does leave only 1% left for the perineum. Apologies, gentlemen. But that adds up to 100. So again, to quick review, Wallace Rule of Nine says for the adult body, take the entire body, divide it into regions, which are multiples of nine. So all I have to do is remember my nines and 18s. So each arm is worth nine, head, neck together are nine, anterior trunk is 18, posterior trunk 18, each leg is 18. So in real life, it is fairly rare for someone to burn the entire arm from axilla to fingertips.
That was my next comment or question.
Yeah.
Please.
No, it's in real life, people don't tend to burn themselves in clean, clear lines. That's the entire limb and nothing but the limb, or the entire X and nothing but the X. It can happen, but tends not to be the case. So then what? What if it's only portions of it? Okay, well, at least on paper, if I said, well, if my whole arm is 9 and it's only half of my arm, okay, half of 9 is 4.5. Okay, I've got that. Well, what if it's like 2/3 of the arm? Well, okay, well, that's 6. But what if it's portions of it that aren't easy fractions, etc.? So this gets to the idea, how do you fine-tune when it's irregular? Well, that's the beauty of the Palmer surface method. So again, Wallace Rule of Nines, fantastic. It's easy-ish to remember. It's not perfect, but it's easiest to remember. And then that gets me started.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. What depth of burns are we including in this?
Yeah, Graham, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because we've said before, but it's so good to emphasize the depth of injury that we're talking about is second and third degree, or to nerd out, we'll call that partial thickness and full thickness. And what I mean by that is partial thickness, the injury has gone entirely through the epidermis, the outermost layer of skin, which is actually pretty thin, but now I'm somewhere into the dermal layer. So I am partially through the dermis.
So if it looks like a sunburn, don't put it in your numbers.
Absolutely. And our caveat, we'll say classical sunburn. I've got two gingers at home. My two boys are redheads. They can look at a picture of the sun and get a sunburn. But yes, classical sunburns, if it looks red, and I'm going to, I'd like to talk about some other strategies to differentiate first and second, because that really is an important distinction for us, because first degree should not be included in the TBSA. They don't need fluid resuscitation for that. It might hurt. Here's your Gatorade, here's your aloe vera, here's your aspirin, but I don't need to pump you full of LR for that. But the depth really matters, and when people get that wrong, that means patients are either over-resuscitated or under-resuscitated. I'll cherry-pick an anecdote here that I think is reflective of many burn centers nationally. And the caveat, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback and find fault with whoever touched the patient before we did. We have the luxury of time and all the resources, and this is our specialty. If I'm working pre-hospital and I see all comers all the time, I don't have the luxury of being an expert in everything all the time. So there's some humility that needs to be sprinkled into the anecdote. But we had, this is some years ago, from the coast of North Carolina, we had a call from the transfer center. We have a 90% burn. 90% burn, guy's cooking in his backyard, propane tank for his grill explodes, 90% involvement. Well, that's serious business. So we move patients out, make room for an ICU bed admission. Well, it's the coast, that's quite some distance away. They send him via fixed wing, which is a big deal. So this is a pretty heady admission. Well, it finally comes a few hours later, and we're expecting a catastrophic injury. Well, in he rolls, and he's sitting up on the gurney chatting with the paramedics, and I'm like, I'm looking at him from 10 feet away, and I'm like thinking to myself, where the burn? Where is the burn? He looked red. His skin was red, but he was not a 90%. He was more like a 0%. This was a glorified sunburn, and not only had they given him fluids, they'd flown him fixed wing. That's an expensive flight for the healthcare system, for him, et cetera, et cetera. And again, backseat, Monday morning quarterbacking, all that stuff. But those are the kinds of things that we hope to avoid by rooting folks in multiple ways to assess depth. Because first degree, we don't think you need to come to a burn center. If you do, it may be to a clinic the next day, but you don't need to be flown in the middle of the night on a fixed wing, aircraft with, tens of thousands of dollars of healthcare resources when it's not really needed.
So talk to us a little bit more about like how to differentiate between that first, yeah, second, and third degree.
Great question. So if we had a visual medium, I could draw some pretty pictures, but I'm going to invite you to use your imagination. So we talked about the outermost layer, the epidermis, which again is relatively thin. And on average, for you and me healthy folks, on average, epidermis is about 5 sheets of paper thick. Just for reference, raw round numbers. Recognizing that's average, but there's differences on all of our bodies. So high touch surfaces, palms and soles, as an example, tend to have thicker epidermis. Or if you're a mechanic and you work with your hands, you're going to have thicker epidermis, as it were, but on average about 5 sheets of paper thick. Well, that's always, as I call it, conveyor belting off anyway. It's always gradually exfoliating off, unless you get a little too ambitious in the shower with your pumice stone and try to help it along. But it's always exfoliating, moving off. It's expected part of the process. Well, that's important structure, but really we start to get worried when the injury exists below that to the dermal layer. And that's, by comparison, on average about 40 sheets of paper thick versus the 5 for the epidermis. Again, those are averages. We could imagine big differences between my back and butt or the dorsum of my hand or my eyelid, as an example, for areas where I have tremendous variability in depth. So the dermal layer is the sweet spot, and that's where I have my surface blood vessels, the surface capillaries that perfuse everything, that give us, wait a minute, cap refill, blanchability, So those are things I'm used to assessing with patients. Do they blanch at all? How long is the cap refill? What else is in the dermis? Let's see. Oh, wait, the roots for my hair follicles. Now, that's near and dear to me since I'm rapidly going bald. But why else does it matter? Well, what we'll find out is adjacent to the root structures of hair follicles is a repository of progenitor stem cells. Well, why does that matter? Well, a stem cell, well, those are the cells that can differentiate into other structures or other types of cells to help with regeneration. So if the burn is deep enough to wipe out stem cells, well, I may not have an easy way to regenerate and grow new tissue. So far we've talked about stem cells in the dermis and blood vessels in the dermis. Really, those are the two most important things that I can think about from a wound healing perspective. Do I have stem cells to spur on new growth? And do I have functional healthy blood vessels to perfuse tissue? Because if the blood vessels are literally toast, well, the tissue is not going to survive. So this is one of the reasons why the depth is so important. Now I'll talk about how to assess it as a clinician at stretcher side or bedside or truck or air care side, as it were. A muddy field side, is,
yeah,
that what we,
exactly,
know?
Yeah,
yeah,
I like it.
Yeah.
So we talk about, the joke that I make for students is you're supposed to, inspect, auscultate, and palpate in that order or whatever. But as the lady on YouTube might say, ain't nobody got time for that. So we look, listen, and feel. So what can we garner from that? Well, so number one, it's whether the epidermis is still attached. Is it adherent? Has the damage been so extensive that the epidermis separates from the dermal layer? Well, we have a name for that. That's called a blister, right? So when the damage, whether it's heat or mechanical stress, because I haven't used that axe to chop wood in a while, and now I have a blister on my palm. So there's some type of stressor or damage, and so the epidermal layer will separate from the dermis. So that's a hallmark of the next layer of injury when I've progressed past epidermis and I'm somewhere in the dermis. So I call this real attached or fake attached. So we know what blisters look like, but maybe you've Maybe you've seen blisters on your own body or on a patient's body where it's not immediately apparent that the epidermis is no longer adherent. Now, I'll use food analogies because people can relate, but what you want to pick up on is, I call it stewed tomato, right? We all know what that is. When you stew it, the skin of the tomato looks like it's on there, but then you touch it, and what happens?
Comes off.
Yeah, it sloughs off. It slips, slides, sloughs off. That's fake attached. So, but the only way that you can find that out is to touch it, right? So one of the easiest low-hanging fruit for anybody to assess burn depth is to not be shy about touching the wound. Now, most of us are pretty shy about doing that because we don't want to hurt the patient. It looks painful, so I'm going to not touch it. I don't want to cause them more pain. And not that I'm advocating that we're all sadists trying to hurt people, but I need to touch to find out. So if we run the list of what can touching or assessing with our hands tell us that eyeballs alone cannot, it's a pretty long list. So first off, is this stewed tomato? Is it really attached or fake attached? Okay, I got a touch to find out. What else? Well, I talked about cap refill. Well, you can only do that by pressing the tissue to begin with to do that blanchability test. What else? Maybe the patient's screaming, maybe they're in pain, but where are they in pain? Can they feel it here? Can they feel it there? Etc. So the degree of pain, the location of pain, how much pain? We would say by touching it, I could find out, is it supple or still like soft or pliant, or does it feel, you know, rigid, hard, leathery? Is it warm or cool? That gives me some indication of whether I'm having surface perfusion or not. So it's a pretty long list when we put it together. There's a lot that I can find out if I touch the patient's wounds.
Without getting, well, I want to tee this up a specific way. So for the purposes of estimating TBSA, the partial thickness, the second degree, the blistery skin or the detached skin down the continuum to the worst, that's a good starting point, and we're counting burned tissue that looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
My question specifically has to do with like a nuance of that type of burn, I guess. But it's common for these, just because you blister doesn't mean that blister is going to stay intact. So how do we start to differentiate between like, well, this is partial thickness blistered skin versus like the dermal layer is completely destroyed and we're getting chunks off in our hands?
Sure. That's a great question. So is this, how do I say, a light second degree or a superficial partial thickness, to put the word salad out there, the smallest amount of depth that puts me into second degreeville, or is this catastrophic and further? Not to dodge the question, but on the front end, when it's really driving the basic two questions that I'll say in the pre-hospital setting, or the even if, you know, patient self presents in an ED, but whoever the initial patient care person is, it really boils down to two concerns. Fluids, will this get included in the fluids, or, you know, my calculation for do they need fluid or not? And then second, triage, like how serious is this? Because that really is what TBSA does for me, right? Do they need to go someplace else? Can I treat them and treat them here? Is this a air transport, ground, whatever that might be? So,
or if we have two patients from the same incident, one might need to go out
first? Fantastic point. And the MCI, who's more serious? Absolutely. Great point. So on the front end, the difference between second and third degree, I mean, I care about it, but I don't care about it as much as the difference between first and second. Because, again, classically, the line in the sand for us is the difference between first and second, meaning I'm somewhere into the dermal layer and impairing that critical structure, the dermal layer, which has all those supporting cast characters. So I do care, but in the moment, I don't care up front because I know I will get to that down the road. That's a question for the burn center and the surgeon. Will I need to graft this? Will I not? What kind of, you know, dermal substitute will I use for this if I can't do autograft, whatever that might be. So hope that makes sense.
No, that's helpful. Again, back to our case, we're in the back of the ambulance with this patient. We pull that blanket down. We're looking for worse than first degree.
No, it's a great way to think about it because, you know, we talk about first, second, third degree. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, to be fair, there's beyond third degree if you choose to extend the umbrella further, like fourth degree, what's including bone, et cetera, et cetera. But for purposes of fluid resuscitation, we're going to say, look, if it's more than first degree, we're going to call that clinically significant. We're going to include that in our TBSA.
Gotcha. So we talked about our palmar surface.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about our rule of nines.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, I think, the mainstays of pre-hospital care with some honorable mentions to some other things. But I think it's worth talking about briefly, what's the gold standard? What's going to be used when they get to you guys in the burn center?
Sure. Great question.
And sorry to interrupt you, but I think this is important because it's really common in the pre-hospital context. You come up with a number and you usually work at it pretty hard. And then you hear later that that number changed dramatically.
Sure.
And it's easy, I think, for pre-hospital providers in some way to kind of take it personally. Like they were trying really hard, sure, to get an accurate number, and then it got over, or they were over or under triaging. And I think it's important to know down the road the tools that are used.
Absolutely. This is a fantastic point. So we get into, I like to think of this as good, better, best, and understanding on the one hand, because of the progression of the wound, because of the time that it takes, I'm going to use some technical terms, we just call it the wound to declare, meaning the dust to settle for what truly is first or truly is second, meaning it might have been borderline and vice versa, second versus third. It takes time for that to happen. And we know 48 hours after injury, how that wound looks can be markedly different than how it looks 17 minutes after injury when EMS rolls up.
So first off, regardless of what tool you're using to estimate total body surface area, the wound is just going to evolve. You see when they're pulled out of whatever event it was is not going to be the same patient that you guys see 48 hours later.
It's absolutely true. It's a key point. And so I think that should inform a spirit of grace with ourselves when we're assessing initially, just realizing I'm going to do the best that I can to give the most accurate assessment that I can with what I see and feel in front of me right now, knowing 2 days from now it will look very different, but I want to be as accurate as I can with my limited tools. Because again, whatever number I come up with will do two things. It will drive fluid resuscitation. Number two, it will drive triage, whether that's, does this patient need to go? How do they need to go? And again, and to your excellent point, in an MCI scenario, who should go first, etc. And then thirdly, I said two things, but I'm coming up with a third. And I can't quantify this. I haven't published on this. I can't, you know, I can just say that it's an is. For human reasons, broken human systems reasons, whatever the first person calls this, whoever that is, whether it's, you know, the ED triage nurse because they walked into the ED someplace, or it's the paramedics in the field or whatever, that first label that gets attached to that patient, somehow that sticks to them like glue. And even though when we see them 6 hours later at a burn center and we realize, well, this isn't really a 20% burn, it's a 40% burn, it takes time for changes to care. And that mental construct of 20%, the initial map, tends to haunt the care, so to speak. It's like turning the Titanic with a canoe paddle. It just takes a while for that to catch up. So that's a third reason to do our best, whoever we are, with our initial assessment, even knowing 2 days from now, it'll be different than what it is right now.
So the wound's going to evolve, and then you guys also have the luxury of time, and and you know, you can really get really detail-oriented, as you have to really assess the wound.
Yeah.
So what tool are you guys using to come up with that final total body surface area?
So why do we need additional tools? Okay. So I would be remiss if I didn't, and I love Wallace Rule of Nines. Please don't get me wrong. It's a fantastic tool. It's middle of the bell curve. It's great because it's, again, easy to remember multiples of nine. There are patients for whom that doesn't work very well. So number one, we know kids. What about kids, right? So Wallace Rule of Nines is adult-centric. And I know you said you have 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mine are 2, 4, 6, and 8, right? But for tiny humans, you know, they have like Wendy's bobbleheads, right? They have huge fat melons and tiny little spindly legs. And so their body proportions are quite different. And so we have to either make a different burn map figure for a 1-year-old, a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, etc., for all these changing body proportions. The other problem with Wallace Rule of Nines is that not everybody is shaped like their ideal body weight suggests they are.
They may have extra epidermis.
That's right. Sharing is caring, right? They may be fluffy a little, apple-shaped, however we want to call that. And there's, I mean, you look at any population health data, and it's not a small portion of the population that actually is overweight, okay? And it is what it is. Well, for those folks who are bigger around the middle, so to speak, that truncal obesity in particular, Rule of Nines is not so good because the trunk contains proportionally more of the skin. And this is getting a little bit into the weeds, but there's a construct called the Rule of Fives. So it says, well, for, you know, the morbidly obese patient who has, you know, proportionally a much larger trunk, an abdomen, well, it needs to get more weight than 18, a multiple of 9. And therefore, proportionally, the arms and legs would get less, etc. So I'll let folks look that up. It's called the Rule of Fives, but it basically highlights, again, a challenge of the Wallace Rule of Nines is not so great for kids. Number two, not everybody's shaped like that. That's the beauty of the palmar surface method. But for a 60% burn, do I want to do 60 palms? That becomes prohibitive too. So one middle ground is to say, well, let's look at average proportions of bodies over age groups. So we have neonates up to, let's say, 1 year of age, and we have 2 to 4, for example, then 5 and 6, 7 year olds, etc. So we have different age brackets. And we also say, well, another problem with the Rule of Nines is it's not typically the whole arm. What if it's only the forearm? What if it's only the upper arm? What if it's not the whole leg? What if it's only the thigh? So the notional sense is we divide the leg into smaller pieces. We divide the arm into smaller pieces. Well, that's called the Lund-Browder chart, which some folks may have heard of. So it looks at those two problems with the Wallace Rule of Nines, which is that there are age-related changes to body proportions. And what else? It's typically not all of one body part. It's some of it. So the Lund-Browder chart is a finer brush, if you will, and gives us a lot more mileage. The downside, nobody's going to memorize that. It's basically an Excel spreadsheet. Nobody's going to memorize that. Now, I will put a caveat out there. with the advent of what we're in 2024 now, there's an app for that, right? And pre-hospital folks are pretty cagey about having their cognitive aids, right? Because it's them and their buddy in the truck, right? So what can I have on my phone as a resource? So there's, again, I don't own stock. There's plenty of apps out there where I can shade with my finger and it'll give me some kind of TBSA, et cetera. But tools are evolving when there's limitations, I guess is the moral of the story there. But in a burn center, we probably start with the Lund-Browder chart, supplement that with the Palmer surface method for scattered stuff, if it's not even the whole forearm, but some of that. And because we all think differently based on our role, I would use Lund-Browder and Palmer surface method. My burn surgeon coming in, she's verbalized that she's thinking in terms of square centimeters. Huh? What? That makes no sense to me.
Like bust out a ruler?
Well, she's got kind of templates in her mind. Why? Because that's how skin grafts are measured, right? So when we have donated skin or whatever, it's square centimeters. So again, that's native to her. She can tell you exactly what, I don't know, 70 square centimeters look like. I can't. I don't think that way, but the tool of use is the one that the person uses often, right? So I would say Lund-Browder is fantastic, but for a pre-hospital personnel who's, you know, they don't have time for that, practicing rule of nines is a good place to start. I'll add one more caveat there. There's been some data to say, to compare, like this notion of, you may have heard the term inter-rater reliability, you know, so here's a burn patient. You look at them. Tell me what you think. Ross, you look at them. You tell me what you think. How'd we do? How do we compare to each other? And the literature suggests, and this is not really shocking when you think about it, suggests what is most important is not necessarily the tool. It's whether people practice with that tool, right? So you can get really good at Palmer surface method, as an example, or get really good at Wallace Rule of Nines.
And I think that's a phenomenal tip, that you get good at what you use.
Oh, absolutely. I'm thinking back to one of your prior episodes of the distinction between, you know, like difficult airways, right? What's better, a Miller or a Mac? Well, it's whichever one you're used
exactly.
to.
Exactly. Know?
Again, not my lane, but definitely a common refrain, right?
Yeah.
So, or good, better, best, I guess.
Wow, some really good stuff in this episode. We're going to pause here and call this part one. To recap, the most important thing for us as pre-hospital providers is to first address the three things most likely to kill a burn patient early. Those are traumatic injuries or some other form of shock, airway loss, or an inhalation injury leading to alveolar damage or some other toxic poisoning. As a reminder, go back and listen to episode 19 of EMS Cast, where we discuss carbon monoxide poisoning, and episode 39 on cyanide poisoning for how to address these specific inhalation toxicities. Once we've addressed the life threats, only then should we move on to addressing the burn itself. First, focus on pain control. There's a lot of literature showing the devastating PTSD that these burn patients can experience from just their uncontrolled pain. If you can safely do so, pain control is incredibly important. Next, we'll want to estimate the TBSA. Remember, only second and third degree burns count. First degree burns, which look like sunburns, do not get calculated in our total body surface area of burn. There are two down and dirty methods for estimating total body surface area burned in the pre-hospital setting. First, you're going to want to make sure the patient is completely exposed, so you're not missing any areas or secondary trauma. If the burn is very large and involving whole body parts, you're probably going to want to use the rule of nines, realizing that the rule of nines is adult-centric, and for a pediatric patient, it'll be the rule of fives, giving more weight to the head. If the burn is very patchy and doesn't involve the entire extremity, then something like the Palmer surface rule will be easier, quicker, and involve less math. Remember, it's the size of the patient's palm, including the fingers that are closed together. Once we have an idea of the total area, roughly 20% is going to get us to that threshold that we consider a critical burn. This is the point at which you don't only have just the local tissue inflammatory response, but you may actually get a systemic inflammatory response that will lead to capillary leak and just significant fluid losses throughout the body. When we're thinking about fluid replacement needs for the patient, the modified Brooks and the Parkland formula are two of the most commonly referenced methods and the ones you'll probably be tested on. This involves calculating 2 to 4 milliliters per kilogram times the total body surface area burned. This calculation gives us the expected fluid loss in the first 24 hours, with most of that occurring in the first 8 hours. But remember, this takes hours to develop and occur. And while it's important to stay ahead of these fluid losses, studies actually show us that most burn patients tend to be over-resuscitated, not under-resuscitated. And the amount of fluids we start in the pre-hospital setting tends to get continued in the hospital setting. So we need to be careful because we set the stage. In addition, this involves a carnival trick and attempting to guess the patient's weight, and then a significant amount of math while we're dealing with a critical patient. It's just not set up for success in the pre-hospital setting. So next episode, we'll share the preferred method of fluid replacement in the pre-hospital setting for these patients. And this should significantly simplify your approach and care and help prevent fluid overloading these patients. Remember, if they're hypotensive in the first moments after the injury, it's not the burn shock. It's not the fluid losses from the burn itself. That's going to take hours to develop. So you have to figure out what other shock is happening, and you have to address that appropriately. Join us next month for the completion of this two-part burn series with Derek Miller.